Welcome to the Italian Renaissance Podcast, where we discuss the culture and art of 15th and 16th century Italy. I'm your host, Lawrence Ginangeli. Andiamo avanti. Renaissance people. Well, welcome back to the Italian Renaissance Podcast. It is with extreme pleasure that I am introducing to you all today Dr. Alan Pascuzzi. Alan is an artist and art historian based in Florence who specializes in techniques of Renaissance Italy. He's a Fulbright scholar whose research was realized in his book, Becoming Michelangelo, which is excellent, where he actually copied all of Michelangelo's early drawings in order to provide a new and unique perspective on how we understand Michelangelo's process. Alan is likewise a master sculptor with multi-continental commissions, including in North America, Europe, Australia, and Asia. Renaissance people, Dr. Alan Pascuzzi.
Thanks, Lawrence. Thanks for asking me to do this. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being here. So you've worked on mastering many of the major Renaissance art techniques from the 15th and 16th centuries, right? Which includes drawing, fresco, and sculpture, which is what we're going to talk a lot about today. Can you give us some background on your own work and how and why you set yourself to the task of learning to produce art using these techniques?
Well, it comes from my family background. My uncles were sculptors on Mount Rushmore, and I sort of grew up with it. My mom was a painter, so I grew up with these techniques, oil painting, sculpting. And since my mom had a large collection of art books, I would always, as a kid, just sort of look through the art books. That was just what you did when you didn't have like cell phones and internet. When I started to go to school and started to, you know, do art, it was something that just came naturally. But it wasn't until I got into college where I actually started my college freshman year as an art major. And I had one professor, she was a nun, it was Sister Magdalene Leroux, who was also an art historian and artist. And she said, don't do the art route, do the art history route. And she said, because it's through art history that you're going to be able to go and find the things that you really want to study as an art wise. And she said, then just take art classes at art classical. In fact, her exact words were, you're too classical to be studying modern art. And I took that to heart. So what I started to do is I started to just seek out classes that were going to teach me the basics, printmaking, lithography, the ancient process, figure drawing, and some of the painting. But during my college sort of summers, after learning art history and learning about frescoes and egg tempera and marble carving, what I tried to do is I tried to experiment on my own. I tried to experiment doing sculpture in marble, in fresco and egg tempera, but I knew that I wasn't getting it. I wasn't at the heart of the matter. So it was only when I was in Syracuse University doing my master's, and I had to read a treatise on art called Cennino Cennini. In fact, I actually saw it referenced in an article I was reading, and I said, what is this book? And I got it out of the library and I read it in one night, and it was basically a treatise from 1399. It's called Cennino Cennini's Craftsman's Handbook, and it basically just said, if you want to become an artist in the Renaissance, this is what you have to do. So I started to copy drawings the way he told me, and then when I actually got to Florence as part of my master's, I sought out someone who could teach me fresco. I found a fresco restorer. She was a woman from Spain who taught me the basics in fresco. I found a sculptor, Antonio Di Tommaso, who I studied with him to learn sculpting, and he got me into marble carving. And then it was going to the Uffizi drawing cabinet and drawing from Michelangelo drawings. So it was a self-investigation. In fact, unfortunately, no one could give me what I wanted, and I had to seek it out by myself. And the key was actually this one treatise. And when I was in Florence, and the treatise that I was reading was actually written in Florence, so I knew this was the place to be. This was it. So I found all the materials, and then I started to use them in my own works, and I realized that studying like these Renaissance masters, being in the city of the Renaissance masters, using the same materials as these Renaissance masters, the not logical conclusion was to execute works like the Renaissance masters. And I was fortunate enough to get fresco commissions and sculpture commissions and start doing drawing. And I've never really stopped, because these are materials and techniques that have been used for centuries, and they still work. And if you know how to master them, you can actually pick up where these masters actually left off. So it's a long-winded explanation, but it was a sort of a self-exploration that actually has allowed me to do the things that I'm doing at the moment, even today.
Oh, amazing. That's interesting. So this summer I was giving tours at Daniel Chester French's studio. I don't know if you're familiar with French's work. He did the Lincoln in Washington,
oh, definitely. D.C.
But he trained in Florence. And one of the things that I tell everyone who comes through my tour is, in 1875, he went to Florence, and that still today, sculptors are going to Florence. That is still an active process since the Renaissance through the American Renaissance and even today. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to my next question. Your personal relationship to Florence, but also your relationship to the history of Florence. You have a studio there, and is there like some points of historical reference that inspire you or that you think about as you're moving forward with your art, such as the actual like space itself or certain artists that you're drawn to?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's not a day that goes by that you walk through the streets and you find something new, a plaque saying that, you know, someone walked here or stayed here or something like that. The city itself is unique. And I think anyone who's sensitive enough to, like yourself, sensitive enough to the history, it draws you to the city. And I usually say people don't go to Florence, they're drawn to Florence. And there are various levels. I mean, tourists come to Florence because they want to see the David and the Uffizi and eat gelato and buy leather jackets. But artists are drawn and they know they've got to stay. And unfortunately, it all depends the way you look at it. Fortunately, if you want to do serious art, if you want to do art that will stand the test of time, Florence is one of those cities that you have to come to. If you look at the millions of tourists that are drawn to Florence to see these works of art, that's an extremely powerful mechanism. These works of art on wood with paint and gold and silver and bronze and marble are drawing people. They're spending money. They're coming from all over the world to go see them. And that's really powerful, a really powerful draw. The space of the city itself, like I'm in the artisan section of the city, San Ferdinando and the Oltrarno on the other side. It's not so much the city itself, you know, with the sort of the quote unquote, if you want to get, you know, like cosmic, you know, the physical, you know, sort of like vibrations of the city. It's the people. I've been fortunate enough to work with a number of other artisans, and one in particular, his name is Bruno, who's 85, a master woodworker who I've collaborated with doing things with or just sort of ask him for advice. And he says, in fact, it's fascinating. He says, I'm an ignorant individual. I've learned everything from the workbench. He says, I've never studied from books. I've actually studied with my hands. And that sort of relationship between the creative and the craft is what fascinates me. And these are people who have a complete sort of mastery of their craft, or what they can think they can realize through their hands. Not many people can say that. We can think things, we can read about things, but creating things with your hands, it takes a lot of effort. So yes, the city itself has always drawn me. In fact, I never chose to come to Florence. I just knew I had to be here because this is what I wanted to explore. Walking through the city, yes. Every time I walk past the Duomo of Florence, I just say, you know, Brunelleschi, good job. You know, well done. You know, just what a great dome you did. You know, walking in to go see the David of Michelangelo, there's still that split second where you say, my gosh, that's good. So it's constant being inspired by beauty. And I think if I could sort of come down to the basic. It's you're constantly inspired by beautiful things. And I even tell my students that I teach that we need to see beautiful things because that it's good for the soul. It brings us up. A beautiful church, a beautiful painting, a beautiful sculpture, things that make us go, wow. We need that. It's inspiring. So, and that's what constantly is it constantly keeps me trying to not to outdo them, but to reach that level, to sort of climb that mountain. And it's a constant sort of, drive. So yeah, you're right. It's a constant inspiration is sort of a very blasé term. It's sort of like, entering into that creativity and just letting the river flow, you know, take you with it, I should say.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Renaissance people, if you are enjoying the Italian Renaissance podcast, I have good news. We're now active on Patreon. You can show your love for the show by becoming a patron and get access to additional resources, information, and artworks. Better yet, those who join the Renaissance Master or Renaissance Patron tier will get access to at least one additional podcast episode each month. My goal is to ensure that the main podcast remains a free, accessible source for everyone. Become a patron today through the link in the show notes to support the continued production of new episodes and help build and maintain this community. The Italian Renaissance Shop is now also active on Etsy, linked in the show notes. Sport our logo or choose from a growing selection of Italian art-inspired designs. Discounts are offered to select Patreon tiers as well. Your support has my immortal gratitude. Now, enjoy the show.
So are there any particular Renaissance sculptors that you look at when you're making your work? You try to adopt maybe aspects of their style, or like you said, inspiration's a little maybe too direct.
Superficial, yeah. You know, I think I really believe, and then this is just my opinion, is that, you know, I see very good artists out there. I see a lot of really very skilled artists out there. And the one thing that always shocks me a little bit is that they do just that. They try and take a little bit from this and take a little bit from that and be inspired. And for me, I find that, I mean, I'd love to sculpt like Michelangelo, but I'm not Michelangelo. I'd love to paint like Botticelli, but I'm not Botticelli. I am who I am, so to speak. And I realize you have to settle into your own style. And it's your own imprint. It's your, you have to be, I mean, the reason why these individuals are so sought after is because they said, this is what, like Botticelli, some of his figures are wrong, but who wouldn't want to paint like Botticelli? And I think the whole system that I used, I realized is that it's not a question of trying to paint like Leonardo or paint like Michelangelo. That's easy. That's always resting on what they discovered. What you've got to do is you've got to dig deeper and you've got to find out your own personal imprints. Like, what's my melody? What's my music? What's my artistic style? It's very difficult because you got to believe in yourself enough. So I wouldn't say that I try to sculpt like Michelangelo. I love his force. You know, I love the refinedness of Leonardo, but what I like to do is, okay, well, let's find my niche of my own, because if you follow one person and follow that person, people are always going to say, oh, he took that from. And I always found that it's sort of, I don't want to say cheating. It's not cheating. It's just sort of you're resting on you're leaning on someone else. Right. And so I don't know if that makes it makes any sense. So I think what I'm trying to copy is their passion and passionate about it. And when you can find that, when you open up that door, your style comes out, you know, your style just comes out. And you don't even think about it.
I want to kind of start looking at your works a little bit. And okay. I want us to start talking technique to the best of our ability, because more or less you sculpt using traditional Renaissance techniques.
Yes.
And you did these three figures, and I'm just going to, oh, I got to click on here. I'm just going to scroll through some of your works to get to the image that I'd like to, and we can come and talk about anything specifically. Sure. But the three figures that you just did, the bronze figures for Florida State University in Florence, these three here for people who are watching, can you tell us, these are allegorical figures. Can you tell us what they are, describe them maybe to people who are not looking, but also talk about the technique of bronze casting that you're using and how modernity sort of shifts using Renaissance technique to how you arrived at these figures. Does that make sense?
Sure. Okay, these are three life-size bronze figures. Life-size, I'm meaning about like 5'8", 5'9", okay? They're female figures. They're dressed in very Greek type of clothes. They represent the motto of Florida State University. So it's artes, vitas, modes. In other words, creativity, strength, and character. Artes, creativity, represents all the arts. So she's playing a harp. She has her left foot on a capital. So the harp represents music. The capital represents architecture. Then there's also a palette with brushes, which represents painting, drawing, and painting. And then there's a theater mask, a Greek theater mask, which represents the theater arts. So she represents all of the arts. And on her harp, there's a butterfly, which actually represents the transformation of the soul. You know, that how art transforms you, transcends and transforms. The other figure, Vides, which means strength, has a more virile sort of position. She holds a book in her right hand and she looks down and she reads it, but underneath her right foot there's if I'm not mistaken, there's the Bible, the Plato, and I think Aristotle, okay, the various Plato's Republic and the Nicomachean Ethics. Okay,
just to because I don't know if the audio cut out on your end, it did on mine. You said Plato, the Bible, and Aristotle.
In Aristotle, right, exactly. So the three books that represent sort of like, you know, learning. So it's the concept is strength through learning. So she's reading and she's read all these books. And then the other figure is modes, which means character. And she holds in her left hand a giglio, which is the lily, which is a symbol of Florence. And she's looking down at it as to represent the flowering of your character. So between art and learning, you know, the book learning, it will make your character flourish. Now, all of them have a flame on their head, which basically these are the three torches of Florida State University's motto. So basically the folds in their gowns are basically like the ridges in the torches, and then they have their hair, which actually there's a flame on top of their head, so they're alight with all these concepts. Now, these were done in bronze, and it was a very large commission. It's very rare to get one figure in bronze. It's almost unheard of to get three figures that are actually supposed to be seen as sort of a tripartite composition. And these were all made in the traditional method. I sculpted all of them in clay, so with an iron armature with like wooden inside, okay, wooden side, and then with just clay, regular clay. I sculpted all of them from life. So the female figures were done after doing studies, lots of drawing studies and measurements, sculpted from life. And then I dressed them using actual cloth, which was actually covered with clay. So the figures were complete in clay. Now, if this was in the Renaissance or the Greek and the Renaissance periods, this would have been done completely in wax. So you would have modeled everything, and actually you would have done a clay core, like a scarecrow, and then you would have done the wax. You put wax on top, sculpted all the wax, and then eventually covered everything with a flame-proof material. It's basically a sort of plaster of Paris and dirt. You would heat up this whole sort of mass. The wax would run out, and then you would pour in your molten bronze. The bronze would cool, you would break away the external sort of covering, and basically you would begin your chasing process, you know, your cleaning process. So that's called the lost wax method. It was actually, you did your wax original, your original in wax. Now, basically, I followed that same type of concept, but in this case, I did the sculptures in clay. Then I did a negative mold. So I had these sort of encased in silicone and counterform. And so I created a negative mold. Then from this negative mold, I made a positive wax copy. So basically, I made a wax copy. And then the same process as the Greeks and the Romans, covered it with that flame-proof material, okay, heat it up, the wax runs out, pour in your molten bronze, and then take away the flame-proof material, and then you begin your chasing. So the only real difference is that I just made my original in clay, made a cast of it, and then did the wax original from the cast, whereas in the Renaissance, they did their wax original directly, which was a little more dangerous because the casting went wrong, you had to start all over again. The process took about 2 years, two full years between sculpting and casting. And then the one thing I forgot to mention is that all these figures have to be done in sections. I was even looking with a class at an Etruscan sculpture, the Aringatori in the Archaeological Museum, this one individual who with his right hand up, this Aulus Metellus, and explaining to them that was done in several sections, the head, the arm, okay, and the feet. I basically followed the same concept in these figures. The heads were done cast separately. The torso was cast separately. The arms were cast separately. And then the lower extremities were all cast separately. So in the end, I had to solder these all together, just like they did in the Greek and the Roman era, because you can't cast a complete figure like this with arms and other details. You have to do it in sections and other things like that. So it's a fascinating process. The bronze was melted to 1,300 degrees, like they did in the Greek era. Oh, in the Greek era, they just had wooden furnaces. Now they have protective heat things and stuff like that, but it was poured in the exact same way, okay, using the exact same materials.
So I'm thinking about, if I have my information correct, Benvenuto Cellini's Perseus in the Piazza della Signoria in Florence, right. As far as I understand, is actually solid bronze, and he wanted to do it in a single pour. Is that why it's solid bronze, because that's the cost of being able to, or is it not even, is it a fiction that he did that in a single pour? I don't actually know.
Okay. Here's the lowdown in Benvenuto Cellini's casting of the Perseus. It's actually cast in two separate pieces. Okay. I think the head of Medusa is actually a detail. It's not solid. It's the lost wax process entails, and this is interesting. It's sort of like a chocolate Easter egg or a chocolate Easter bunny. It has the exact same thickness, maybe a little bit thicker, but it's hollow. Now the casting, in fact, if you go to Benvenuto Cellini's autobiography, there's a whole section on this casting, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. I actually found where he cast the Perseus. I had to do it for a lecture. So I went and I found in Via della Pergola in Florence, there's a little plaque that says Benvenuto Cellini cast the bronze here. And by chance, there was someone who was walking out of the building. And I said, excuse me, is there anything left of the Benvenuto Cellini's furnace or anything? And it says, yes, I live in there. And in the basement underneath my apartment, there's still sort of a winch that he probably used to do. Well, the casting, he wanted to do it in all in one piece, is, you know, the whole figure, because it was a lot easier. Now that's a fairly simple figure. The position is fairly simple. It's nude, so there's no drapery. The only really thing difficult is like the back of the head has his own self-portrait. The casting was done in the same way. If you read the account of it, he had problems because the bronze wasn't flowing. It wasn't liquefying enough, and he needed pewter. And he said he went around and he threw all the pewter pots and plates that he had in his house to because when pewter, when it's melted into the bronze, it actually liquefies a little better. And when they analyzed the Benvenuto Cellini's The Perseus, they found in the bronze a high pewter content that totally verifies that story that he threw, you know, pewter in it. And then another thing, I'm just going to go off on a tangent really quickly. There's a direct reference to the wood used to heat the furnace. Woods have different burning temperatures, pine, oak, okay, stuff like that. And at a certain point, he says he sends one of his helpers to go get some of these, I think, if not mistaken, oak beams from, I think, a baker or something like that. I'm not mistaken. Because that wood burns really hot, and he needed to get the furnace hotter. And so you have to imagine that these people, without technological sort of know-how, they just knew that certain wood burned hotter, and that's what they would need. And they threw it into the furnace, and it raised the temperature. He used the exact same process, the exact same lost wax process. The last time I checked, I remember one expert was saying it's not in a single pour. It's probably in a couple. In other words, there's, I think one of the details was actually soldered on. But his account of it just shows the absolute frantic nature of bronze casting, because when you really come down to it, and even when I was casting mine, there's always that element of danger, because the furnace can get really hot, it can explode, you have bronze spattering which could burn right through you, something might go wrong in the sense that it might block, and if things block, then the bronze doesn't flow. And then you only really know if it goes well until after it's done, until you start breaking it away. And it, actually, one of the figures, one of the heads, actually, the casting went bad. And since I had the negative cast of it, I had to recast it. So even in today's modern sort of technology, things can go bad. So that's why what makes even these Renaissance works even more amazing, that they just were exquisite craftsmen. And they knew how to make things actually come out, you know, taking that chance.
Are you involved in the pouring process? Are you in the heat?
Okay. In the Renaissance, the people who were doing most of the casting were bell casters and bronze technicians. I mean, Lorenzo Ghiberti, Donatello, even Cellini lists, gives a full list of all of his helpers. And these were technicians. These were skilled furnace keepers. They knew what they were doing. The artist was part of it up to a certain point. In fact, even it was interesting rereading Cellini. He's directing all of it. Today, it's very difficult to get involved because of safety. You know, you just can't be there. Even though when mine were cast, I wanted to be there, and they kept me. You know, I was right beside him. You had to be careful because bronze spatters, and bronze at 1,300 degrees will literally burn right through you. And when it goes up into the air and it falls down, it already cools and it begins to clink. It goes up hot, comes down cold, and begins to clink in the air. It's really sort of fascinating. Today, the artist prepares everything. It all depends on what kind of artist you are. I know artists who basically just give a little model and they give it to the bronze caster, who then has someone re-sculpt it, blowing it up, and then does the whole process. I didn't want that. I wanted to be there. So I was in the workshop, retouching all the waxes, all the wax positives present at the casting. And then, you know, literally being there with the chasing and doing everything as well. But the actual casting now is so dangerous, and you need technicians. And even they're very, very careful safety, because things can go wrong. So yeah, you have to be very careful. You have to be respectful of the technicians. You can't just go in there, I'm the artist and I want to be part of it. No, you've got to be respectful of their expertise.
Thank you for that insight. I wasn't really sure. Just looking at these, were you intentionally trying to also evoke the three graces with the composition?
Well, that you're dead straight on. When the then director of Florida State University in Florence, Frank Nero, when we were talking about this, he had an idea, and this is if I could step back into a parenthetical discourse, the best works are when someone has the idea and the artist and the person who has the idea, the commissioner, they can work symbiotically and elaborate it. Frank, being an art historian, was very, very well familiar with all, you know, all of art history. He had this idea. He asked me to articulate it, also knowing, you know, various things of art history. And if you look at the great compositions in history, it's not just the artist coming up with the idea. It's the artist working with this initial spark, but adding his spark of the creativity. And it's not taking away from the artist. It's actually saying, well, this is what these what artists do. They're paid visualizers. So Frank had this idea of some sort of a three grace type of thing, you know, three graces, like Botticelli's or the ancient sort of like the there's this one sculpture in the Piccolomini Library in Siena of the three graces, this ancient sculpture of these three female nudes. At first, one of the first models I had were actually female nudes. And then he said, well, why don't we turn it a little more, you know, Greek, a little more Greek and Roman. And that's when I came up with these clothed Greek-like clothed figures. I didn't take it directly from Greece. I could say that it's in the line of it's more universal. You know, they have these universal gowns on. So, and originally I had even envisioned these things sort of like back to back. So they were all back to back as sort of like a, you could walk around it. Mm-hmm. But then he said, well, they have to be representative of the three torches. So they had to be like the motto of FSU, of Florida State University, of the three torches that are connected by a ribbon that says Artis Vitis Modis. So what I did with these figures, that the figures themselves look like the torches with the flames on them. And the ribbon are actually the arms that are actually running, that are actually outstretched. So it was basically the general composition is sort of following the motto, the logo of Artis Vitis Modis. But yes, the simple answer is they're the three graces, the three female concept modified through the Florida State University logo.
That's fantastic. I love the complicated layering of allegory, visual reference, and of course, adapting that to FSU's needs. That's really
Yeah, cool. I love it. Yeah. That's why it works so well.
So is there, before I go on to my final question with you, are there any works that we have here that you'd like to talk about? I just want to note to listeners that what we're looking at are some of, these are plasters?
Okay, this is something I literally just finished. I just brought it to the church this past Wednesday, 2 days ago. This is actually a Saint Anne and a baby Mary done for a tabernacle just outside the city. I did the original in clay, and then since this has to go outside, this is a resin work. In other words, I did it in clay, did a negative cast, and then did the positive mold in a resin. And this is basically to evoke a painting that was in this tabernacle from the 1420s of a Saint Anne holding the baby Maria. You really see them often, because usually it's Mary and the Christ child, but this is actually Saint Anne with her baby daughter, which is actually, yeah. Which is, so I jumped at the chance. The little daughter, the little girl is, well, I should say Mary is actually the portrait of my little daughter. Okay. Amelia. So I put her in there as well. So this is the most recent one. There is one that that has always been interesting. I think it's a nativity. There it is. Yeah. That one, the original is actually in Australia, in a chapel in a church in Australia. And I made a copy of it I made a second copy of it because I liked it so much. It's Joseph, Mary, and the baby Jesus, which is actually a portrait of my son Elijah when he was, I think, 4 or 5 months old. I took all the measurements of him and I did him exact as a little baby. But that one, since I was very limited in the space that I had, it was a semicircular chapel that I had to put the Nativity, the angel, and then the three shepherds. I didn't have much space to show the nativity, so which actually worked perfectly because the three figures of Joseph, Mary, and the Christ child are jammed right against the ox and the donkey, the ass. And there's even a little cat down below in the right hand side. I don't know if you can see it. The cat is actually a portrait of the cat the priest cat in the church in Australia. But there are biblical references to a cat that was present at the nativity. So it actually follows some of the iconographical legends, sort of speak as well. But this one, for the composition, the melding between the animals and the humans and the star, it just worked really well. It just sometimes when you're given limitations, you can work around them, and it actually works. It just works by itself for some reason. It's one of those works that everything just sort of flowed perfectly.
Yeah, and just to point it out, only because I love it so much, is this port. We were just talking about Frank Nero, and he has interviewed for the show. I don't know if he's going to air before or after yours.
Okay.
But on the left here, for those of you watching, it's a portrait medal. And my listeners will know I'm obsessed with Pisanello's and the Mehmed the Conqueror portrait medal. Sure. That there's like three different copies of that, three different versions of it. But these are, I mean, it's a trend. Is it the size of a proper Renaissance portrait medal?
Okay, this one you're right on that one too. Frank was the director of Fleurs de University, was going away, and I said we've got to do something, and you just can't give him a little plaque and saying, oh, thank you, Frank, for all your work. And it was a 1 week before he was going to leave, or before we're going to have and I said to some of the people at FSU, I said, get me a photograph of Frank. Just don't tell him why you're doing it. Just get me a profile image of him. So they got me the image, and basically it is sort of the Pisanello thing. It's a little bit larger. It's about maybe a foot in diameter, and he's got the, you know, the laurel wreath on his head, and basically it's, you know, saying he's a, you know, the Duke's, okay, he's, you know, he's the guy, he's the head guy. You know, he's you know, the studioso, he's the scholar. But you know, it was interesting because this is, you know, I know Frank is a great friend. This was one way of commemorating him, and I sort of understood why, you know, what this was all about. This is why you do these things, to commemorate not only the person but their actions, their history. And I gave it to him, and he was quite taken with it. But yeah, it is right in the line of the Renaissance medallions, even the you know, the Greek coins and Roman emperors, and that's what it's all about. I tried to, you know, him Nero, you know, as sort of a play on him being Nero, and it was the least I could do. He's a great guy and a great colleague,
I'm a loyalist. I would sport this in my portrait to show which family I support. Okay, so let me just get to the final question here, and it is your book. So Becoming Michelangelo, Apprenticing to the Master and Discovering the Artist Through His Drawings. I've read it in full. You signed a copy for me on the train.
Memorable. You were the first one I think I signed. So you're memorable.
Yes, you said that too. You said that. So it's what it is doing. This book is detailing your work as a Fulbright scholar, copying Michelangelo's drawings. And I think that's really important because drawings are often considered like a secondary or tertiary art, even though really that's not necessarily the case. But this is a scholarly method you're using, producing and reproducing sort of chronologically, right? You did the best you could to get insight to his process. Mm-hmm. So can you talk us through some of that insight that you acquired by so-called apprenticing to Michelangelo?
Okay, it all comes back to that one moment. I was in my graduate room in Syracuse University, and when I was reading Cennino Cennini, and right at the very beginning, he says, if you want to learn to become an artist, you have to pick one artist, pick the best one that you know, and copy everything from him. And it just dawned on me, because a lot of artists do this and do that and do study here, study there. And I said, you know, I'm going to do it the way Cennino Cennini did, in the way that probably all the other great artists did. So being sort of always enamored of Michelangelo, because my mom had a big Michelangelo book that I was always looked through when I was a little kid, I got out these books on his drawings and I started the copying them every night. You know how masters is a really tough moment because you're doing a lot of reading. And at night I didn't have a TV. So I just kept on drawing. And what happened was, as I was drawing his drawings, I realized that I started to see, like, I would do, you know, an early drawing and then I would do a later drawing and said, wow, his anatomy had improved. And I thought, well, how is that possible? Because he's Michelangelo, right? I mean, shouldn't he be like, you know, a genius? And I realized, well, I could see him getting better. I could see him getting better from his early to his late. And I said, what would be interesting to track that? So when I went on to my PhD and I sought out a Michelangelo expert, was this Professor William Wallace, who's a great, not the one, the Scottish Independence William Wallace, but William Wallace, the Michelangelo scholar. And I said to him, listen, I want to do Michelangelo's drawings because I think I found a way to understand an aspect that you can't understand unless you actually experience it firsthand the way he did. And he gave me the green light. He said, go and do it. So what I did was, I, in the course of my graduate, my doctoral work, I recopied them. It actually was the third time that I was copying over these drawings. There was 135 drawings. I recopied them, all of them three times over. But this time I had an opportunity not to do it from books, but to do it from the actual drawings. So in fact, I got a Fulbright proposing this, and I went to Florence and I copied the drawings there. And I went to Paris in the Louvre, and I went to London in the British Museum. I went to Cleveland and copied the ones that they had there. I went to New York and copied them there. And when you're copying from these drawings, you're literally reproducing every line. You're looking at every single line that art historians, yes, they look at drawings, but copying it means that you have to look at every single line, every single shadow. And that allows you to just sort of dive into the thing. And that allowed me to write a chronological sort of progression of Michelangelo getting better, you know, becoming the Michelangelo. But on the flip side of that, copying his drawings allowed me to apprentice myself to him, the way Cennini said. So it wasn't just art historical, it was artistical. So what I realized is that was the key to opening up my own style. So you're drawing like Michelangelo, and in any apprenticeship in the Renaissance, it was, yes, you're supposed to draw like the master, but then eventually you're supposed to go beyond that, open up your own workshop and do your own work. And that's what Raphael did. Raphael was very much like Perugino. You can't even distinguish early Raphael from late Perugino, but then he takes it, he puts it into fifth gear, and he goes and he becomes the Raphael that we all know and love. And that system, that concept was interesting. It was liberating because I was able to recreate an artistic education process that really isn't used anymore. I mean, I know that people copy drawings, but this took me 20 years to do. I mean, this took me years to do. And to get what you're saying, even Vasari said it, and Michelangelo said it, and Leonardo, if you don't have drawing, you don't have anything. If you know how to draw well, you can paint well. If you know how to draw well, you can sculpt well. If you know how to draw, you can conceptually think of things. And because you can articulate it with your hand. So drawing is, you know, I see a lot of artists who can paint and they can maybe sculpt, but you can see that they never go beyond that because they've never broken that barrier through drawing. They've never broken that barrier of mind and hand. I mean, they're very good. I'm not saying they're not excellent. But the drawing, you have to start with drawing. You have to master it. In fact, I think Verrocchio said, or one of the artists said, that it has to be like breathing. If you're avoiding doing drawings, that means that, you know, you're not breathing well. you're not doing it the way you should do. So the whole book is an art historical, it's a serious art historical study, but it's also in certain cases autobiographical. because what I'm trying to show through my own experiences is what it takes to become a Michelangelo. You know, what you have to know, what you have to struggle with, what you have to deal with. So the book, in fact, I'd love to do a sequel to it, you know, when Michelangelo's later drawings, because now as a middle-aged man, I know what it's like to be a middle-aged artist and struggle with it. It's like struggling all the time, for Pete's sake. But it's one of those books that, again, this was my dissertation, which was scholarly, but this one, I wanted to make it more accessible. And so there's a lot of anecdotes about being in Florence, because I did all of this research in Florence. Okay, that's why. So the book could only have been written for me. I did everything in Florence, so it totally is in line with what Michelangelo was all about. He studied here. He learned how to become Michelangelo here in Florence.
Yeah, and I'll just say, you know, I have my copy here. It is. It really is an amazing book, and it gives you a different, you know, we're not really reading about carving fawns' heads in the Medici garden and
right.
instant brilliance. Right. It's really about process, but it's also a little bit of memoir, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So mm-hmm. it's a really interesting interaction with not the glory and excellence of a perfect
right.
sculpture that's been divinely inspired, but really right. how an artist is relating a very rigorous and intense process. And it also mm-hmm. is beautiful. The paper is beautiful. The illustrations, if you can see them, are, oh, no, it disappears on my backdrop, are beautiful. highly recommended. And I'm going to put the link for this, if listeners are interested, in the show notes so that they'll have easy access to it.
Okay.
The Amazon that. Or wherever it's available. Alan, any closing yes. thoughts before we say goodbye?
No, I appreciate, you know, speaking like this to you. It's not very often. In fact, it never really happens that someone is sensitive enough to look into these things. And so I appreciate your passion about this. And I think that's why we're relating to this, is, you know, passionate people sort of connect. And I guess the main thing is that, you know, everything that I do is, you know, you can look at the gaining of it, you know, financial gain, but the true passion is just when you're totally enthralled with something, and that just leads you, you know, to these really interesting and stimulating type of things, which is what I what we're doing right now. So I appreciate your passion about this. I really do.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. We're going to say goodbye to our Renaissance people, and thank you everyone for tuning in. Until next time, arrivederci.
Okay. Arrivederci.